Well, our plan this morning is to go back to the patriarchs and to talk a little bit about Jacob and about his experience in Haran. So we're going to start off with a children's class. So I don't think we have any children, except the grown-up kind. But if you all want to come forward, those of you who feel childlike, maybe my daughters could come up anyway. Victoria and Elise. Does it take a lot of bravery to come forward in children's class? Not too much. You probably feel a little bit like David and Goliath here. Okay, Ashley's going to join y'all. So I have a verse this morning from 1 Samuel 2, verse 30. It says, "Therefore the Lord God of Israel says, I said indeed that your house and the house of your father would walk before me forever. But now the Lord says, far be it from me." So do you all know who he's talking to here? Sounds like he's talking to somebody pretty bad, doesn't it? Who do you think he might be talking to? Maybe a tax collector. So he says, "For those who honor me, I will honor, and those who despise me shall be lightly esteemed." So God was talking to Eli here, and he was talking about Eli's sons and the fact that God was not going to honor Eli and give him descendants who would be priests because of the fact that his sons were not behaving. So we're going to be talking about Jacob this morning. And I think that Jacob, at least in the time that we're going to study here, liked money pretty well. So do you think people had a lot of money back in Jacob's day? No, they didn't. What did they have? Yes, Victoria. A little bit of money. Okay. Elise, what do you think Jacob had a lot of?
Teddy bears.
That's a good guess. In your clothes, but not quite. Okay, so Jacob, he had a lot of children. Okay, that's a good thing to have, right? So how many children did Jacob have?
30.
No, he had about 13. And so he was focused on maybe his children a little bit, but he also was focused on getting lots of camels and sheep and goats and cows. So back then, whenever you had a lot of stuff, you had a lot of animals. So have any of you all heard of J.C. Penney? What do you know about J.C. Penney? Okay, so I don't know what that means. So J.C. Penney's a store, right? And I think there's one in Lynchburg. If you're interested, you could go to J.C. Penney now. But Jim C. Penney was from a very poor family. He was one of 12 children. That's a lot of children, isn't it? And when he was 8 years old, so Victoria, you're a little over eight, right? So when he was 8 years old, his dad came to him and he said, "You know what, Jim? Times are hard, and so I want you to start making money, and you're going to pay for all your own clothes from here forward." What kind of clothes would you have if you had to pay for your own clothes?
I would pick a princess.
You would pick princess dresses. Well, you would have to make money, first of all, to have these princess dresses. So Jim Penney thought to himself, "What can I do to make some money so I can wear clothes to school this fall?" And so what do you think he did? Yes, Victoria. So he went around asking for jobs. He did a little bit. He made a little bit of money, and he went out and he bought a pig. That's a weird thing to buy if you're wanting to make money, isn't it? Well, so he thought to himself, "You know, I'm going to raise this pig up. And whenever it's full grown, then I will sell it and I'll have money from that pig." And so he kept making some money from little odd jobs he was doing, and he bought more pigs. And one day his dad came to him and he said, "Jim, you have to sell those pigs. And Jim said, why do I have to sell the pigs? He didn't want to sell the pigs. The pigs weren't full grown, and they wouldn't get a lot of money for them. And his dad said, what do you think his dad said? Why would you sell pigs? Well, his dad said, the neighbors don't like how the pigs smell. And you can understand that. If you had pigs next door to you, would you like that? You'd like them over by Milo's house. So his father explained to him the golden rule. And he said that they would follow the golden rule, even if it cost them money. And so if the neighbors didn't like how the pigs smelled, they would sell them and get rid of them. And Jim did just that. And so after he graduated from high school, his father helped him get a job in a little store. And he continued to work on his father's farm as well in the store. But at some point in the early 1900s, the doctors thought he was getting tuberculosis. And tuberculosis was bad. They didn't have any medicines to treat tuberculosis. So what they did when people got TB symptoms is they sent them out west, like west from here. So he ended up in Wyoming. There wasn't really much in Wyoming, but there was dry weather. And so he bought into a little store out there, and he sold things to miners. What are miners? Well, they could be people under 18, but in this case, he was selling it to people who dug stuff out of the dirt, so like silver miners or metal miners of some kind. And so the interesting thing is he worked really hard and he started making money, and he had a number of stores, and he had men who managed those stores for him. And he called them the Golden Rule Stores. And you would think, now Jim is a Christian, right? He loves Jesus and he's working hard because he loves Jesus. But he didn't. His dad was a preacher, and his dad did love Jesus, and he had taught Jim to work really hard, but he had not taught Jim to love Jesus. And so he worked hard, and he made a lot of money, and then something happened. It happened in 1929. Do any of you know what happened in 1929? Some of the older people know. Joe is saying the Depression. Does anybody know what happened in the Depression? People got really sad, didn't they? Well, they lost a lot of money. The stock market went bust, and people lost their savings. The banks went under. And so nobody had money to buy stuff that JCPenney was selling. And the stores started to have trouble. They had a whole bunch of stuff to sell and no one to sell it to. Well, people would buy it, but they didn't have money to pay for it. So he was ruined. And he had no money left. And he tried to pay his workers as long as he could because he liked the people who was working for him. And he thought to himself, I'll pay them as long as I can. Maybe things will turn around. And it didn't get better. And he got more and more sad. And he had a nervous breakdown. And so he went to the hospital. Is that what you do when you're sick? Do people get better in the hospital? Well, some people do. Some people have to get home from the hospital to get better. So they're in a sanatorium, which is a hospital to help people get healthy from nervous conditions. He went to a chapel service, and he heard the hymn, God Will Take Care of You. Have you all ever heard of that hymn? And if you can imagine, this was just the song he needed to hear. Be not dismayed, whatever betide, God will take care of you. And he realized he had been trying to take care of himself, and now he needed to let God take care of him. And at this point, JCPenney committed his life to God, and he committed as well that he would give as much of his money as he could to God, a minimum of 10%. And as time went by, he gave more and more to God. And by the time of his death, he was giving 90% of his income away, and he was more focused on the things of God than ever before. And I think it's a story about someone whose life was kind of out of balance, and then it got back into balance. So we'll think about this morning as we hear about Jacob. So you all can go back to your parents. I guess, Ashley, you don't have to go back to your parents. So as I was thinking about this story of Jacob, my mind went to Job. So in Job 1:1-5, we find out that Job was the richest man in the east. And it says about him that he had 7 sons and 3 daughters, so that's 10 children, and his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household. So this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. And it goes on to talk about the things that Job's children did and stuff like that. And even though Job was very wealthy, he didn't have a lot of money. Does anybody know when money was first minted? Nobody does. Seems like it's been around forever, right? Did they have money back in Jacob's day? Sounds like a trick question, doesn't it? Well, they did sort of have money, so they would have money by weight. Okay, so when we have money now, our money actually isn't worth a whole lot as far as the metal that's in it, but it's just the government tells us it's worth something, so it's worth something. But back in Jacob's day, if you had a shekel of silver, they just would weigh a shekel of silver, and they would say, okay, this is a shekel of silver. It didn't have anybody's picture on it. They didn't have a picture of, you know, George Washington or anything. George Washington was even alive back then. Or the Caesar. That was much later. So it's the kingdom of Lydia that invented money the way we think of money today. And that was probably, 700 or 800 years later than this. So when people had money back then, they invested it in livestock. And so the livestock was what they had. And there are some important things we can see about Job. So Job, it was much more important for him to maintain his relationship with God than to have stuff. So he didn't seem to pursue wealth. When he found out about his losses, it says, then Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and fell to the ground and worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. So we can be certain that Job was able to weather the storms that he faced because of the fact that before his disaster, he had invested himself in worship of God. And Jesus said, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And the point is that if we treasure the stuff that's around us, when we lose it, it will be devastating to us. And as we read through this passage, we're going to see that Jacob was pretty focused on accumulating wealth and that this was probably more important to him than his relationship with his family or his relationship with God, certainly more important than his relationship with Laban, his father-in-law. So we're going to go to Genesis chapter 29. We're going to read the end of that and go on into Genesis 30. And we'll try to go through here relatively quickly, but when the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. So Leah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Reuben, for she said, the Lord has surely looked on my affliction. Now, therefore, my husband will love me. Then she conceived again and bore a son and said, because the Lord has heard that I am unloved, he has therefore given me this son also. And she called his name Simeon. She conceived again and bore a son and said, now this time my husband will become attached to me because I have borne him 3 sons. Therefore his name was called Levi. And she conceived again and bore a son and said, now I will praise the Lord. Therefore she called his name Judah. Then she stopped bearing. Now when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister and said to Jacob, give me children or else I die. And Jacob's anger was aroused against Rachel, and he said, am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb? So she said, here is my name maid Bilhah, go into her, and she will bear a child on my knees. that I also may have children by her. Then she gave him Bilhah, her maid. Conceived and bore Jacob a son. Then Rachel said, God has judged my case, and he has also heard my voice and given me a son. Therefore she called his name Dan. And Rachel's maid Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. Then Rachel said, with great wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister, and indeed I have prevailed. So she called his name Naphtali. When saw that she had stopped bearing, she took Zilpah, her maid, and gave her to Jacob as a wife. And Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a son. Then Leah said, a troop comes. So she called his name Gad. And Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a second son. Then Leah said, I am happy, for the daughters will call me blessed. So she called his name Asher. Now Reuben went in the days of wheat harvest and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. But she said to her, is it a small matter that you have taken away my husband? Would you take away my son's mandrakes also? And Rachel said, therefore he will lie with you tonight for your son's mandrakes. When Jacob came out of the field in the evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, you must come in to me, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes. And he lay with her that night, and God listened to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. Leah said, God has given me wages because I have given my maid to my husband. So she called his name Issachar. Then Leah conceived again and bore Jacob a sixth son. And Leah said, God has endowed me with a good endowment. Now my husband will dwell with me because I have borne him six sons. So she called his name Zebulun. Afterwards, she bore a daughter and called her name Dinah. Then God remembered Rachel, and God listened to her and opened her womb. And she conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. So she called his name Joseph and said, the Lord shall add to me another son. So I don't know what you think when you read this story. When I first read over this, I thought to myself, you know, this reminds me a lot of the genealogies. How many of you all like genealogies? It's a couple who sort of like them, okay? Matthew 1 is one of the most boring parts of the Bible. I always thought that. Yes, there's names, and yes, it's sort of interesting, I guess. It's a little different if it's your own genealogy, right? If you say, my dad and my granddad and going all the way back, that's sort of interesting. If you tell stories about the people, that's interesting. But what's not interesting is just to read a list of names. And it feels a little bit like this. And as I read over this, one of the things that stands out to me is how little Jacob is in this story. So it's safe to assume, I think, that Jacob was herding sheep a lot. He wasn't around. And there was a lot of tension here. None of the people in this story are happy. So Jacob wasn't happy. Jacob is working 14 years for two wives, only one of whom he wanted to work for. And he felt like Laban had cheated him. And Laban had cheated him, hadn't he? Leah felt that she was unloved. She gave Jacob six sons, lots more than Rachel did, but Jacob still loved Leah more. In fact, it says about Leah that she felt unloved. And Rachel was devastated by the fact that she didn't have children. And more than that, her sister had children, which meant the problem was hers and not her husband's. And this is one of the saddest stories in the Bible. You have no description for what Leah was thinking here, and yet you know exactly what she was thinking based on what she named her children. And it's telling, isn't it, that Jacob didn't name the children. You can imagine him telling his wives, you can call them anything you want, just don't call them late for dinner. And sometimes people say that. So what does the first one, Reuben, see a son, is what it means. God has seen my misery and has given me a son. And of the two wives, Leah seems to really have had a relationship, a desire to know God, a real connection with him. Simeon heard. And unfortunately, Leah did not feel heard by her husband. But she knew that God had heard her cries. She still felt unloved and undesired, and yet God was listening to her. I am heard. Levi, joined or attached, is what that name means. And Leah was convinced that at last her husband would truly be joined to her because of what she was giving him. She had given him 3 sons already. And if we were keeping score, we would say Leah is ahead 3 sons to 0 for Rachel. And then Judah, thanks to God. And we can see the Joth at the end of this name. And anytime you see that, that's a reference to God. It's a shortened form of Jehovah or Yahweh. And this is the first place in Scripture that we have any recording of someone thanking God for anything. Did Abraham and Isaac ever thank God? Well, I'm sure they did. I don't think there's any question that when Isaac was born, that Abraham lifted up his voice and thanked God. But it's not recorded. And here we have an unloved, unwanted woman who feels separated from her husband, who says, thank you, God. I want to name my son, thanking him for what is given to me. Joseph adding, and the Bible makes it clear that Rachel thought that her fertility issues were done here. Joseph was going to be the first of many sons that she would bear, and Rachel would be a proud mother of them all. Other names, Dan, it means judgment. Naphtali means wrestling. Gad, a troop. Issachar, hired. And Zebulun, dwelling. And names are important in the Old Testament. We can see that with God changing Abram and Sarai's names to Abraham and Sarah. The name Methuselah means, when he is dead, it shall be said, which is a weird name to give a child. If you think about things that you're going to name your children, that is the weirdest thing I can think of to name a child. And somebody must have had a revelation that something was going to happen when Methuselah died, and he lived a long time. And if you do the math, you figure out that the year that he died was the year that the flood came. So interestingly, it seems as though the mothers named their children. Jacob was around, but he didn't name the children. And a lot of parents, when they name their children, name them family names. So my first name is actually Vincent, and my son's first name is Vincent. My father's first name was Vincent too, and my grandfather's first name was Vincent. We all have different middle names. And so, you know, you could understand if they decided to recycle some of these names and say, you know, we're going to name one of our sons Abram or Isaac, or something else. Also, a lot of people use Bible names, but obviously in Jacob's time, that wasn't really an option either, was it? They didn't have the Bible, so they couldn't pick names out of it. And based on these names, I would say that Leah developed a real relationship with God, and I'm a little more doubtful about Rachel. And we know that later on, she stole her family's idols when they were leaving. And more than that, we can see that Leah desperately wanted to have a close relationship with Jacob, and it never happened. I think this particularly shows up in the name of Levi, attached or joined. Leah wanted a connection with her husband. So Jacob ended up with 2 wives and 2 concubines and a whole raft of children, but it seemed like he wanted something else. He wanted wealth. And wealth in that culture was not a matter of having a lot of gold and silver and jewels. It was represented by having a lot of livestock. Psalms 127, 3-5 says, behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hands of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies in the gate. And I think the important thing to remember is that children are a blessing, but they are a blessing that take investment to bring in up in what is right. And even then, there is no guarantee that they'll do everything that you want. But it is more likely to happen if you invest yourself in raising them. And I'm afraid that Jacob left a lot of child rearing to his wives. And we can see this later on in his relationship with them, in their relationships with Joseph. Things just did not go well, did they? And that's kind of sad. And we're going to look at that a little bit more later on. So I'd like to read the end of Genesis chapter 30 now. And this is the story of how Jacob worked for Laban after he had worked for his wives. So Genesis 30, verse 25. And it came to pass when Rachel had borne Joseph that Jacob said to Laban, "Send me away that I may go to my own place and to my country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, and let me go, for you know my service which I have done for you." And Laban said to him, "Please stay if I have found favor in your eyes, for I have learned by experience that the Lord has blessed me for your sake." Then he said, "Name me your wages, and I will give it." So Jacob said to him, "You know how I've served you and how your livestock has been with me. For what you had before I came was little, and it has increased to a great amount. The Lord has blessed you since my coming. And now, when shall I provide for my own house?" So he said, "What shall I give you?" And Jacob said, "You shall not give me anything. If you will do this thing for me, I will again feed and keep your flocks. Let me pass through all your flock today, removing from there all the speckled and spotted sheep and all the brown ones among the lambs and the spotted and speckled among the goats, and these shall be my wages. So my righteousness will answer for me in time to come. When the subject of my wages comes before you, every one that is not speckled and spotted among the goats and brown among the lambs will be considered stolen if it is with me." And Laban said, "Oh, that it were according to your word." So he removed that day the male goats that were speckled and spotted, all the female goats that were speckled and spotted, every one that had some white in it, and all the brown ones among the lambs, and gave them into the hands of his sons. Then he put 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob fed the rest of Laban's flocks. Now Jacob took for himself rods of green poplar, and of the almond and chestnut trees, peeled white strips in them, and exposed the white which was in the rods. And the rods which he had peeled, he set before the flocks in the gutters and the watering troughs where the flocks came to drink, so that they should conceive when they came to drink. So the flocks conceived before the rods, and the flocks brought forth streaked, speckled, and spotted. Then Jacob separated the lambs and made the flocks face toward the streaked and all the brown in the flock of Laban. But he put his own flocks by themselves and did not put them with Laban's flock. And it came to pass, whenever the stronger livestock conceived, that Jacob placed the rods before the eyes of the livestock in the gutters that they might conceive in the rods. But when the flocks were feeble, he did not put them in, so the feebler were Laban's and the stronger Jacob's. Thus the man became exceedingly prosperous and had large flocks, female and male servants, and camels and donkeys. Now, when you read this story, this is one of the silliest stories in the Bible. How many of you all think that the reason why there were lots of speckled and spotted sheep and goats born was because Jacob had peeled these wands and put them in front of these animals? How many of you all believe in genetics? There's a couple. Yeah, genetics seems like it's a good choice. So can you change somebody's genes by making them look at wands, peeled sticks? Seems unlikely, doesn't it? So we have here two men who want something from each other. And Laban understood that he was blessed because Jacob was working for him. And he wanted that blessing, but he didn't want to pay for it. And so Jacob said, "You know, I'll take these kinds of sheep and goats." And immediately Laban went through and pulled all of those kind out. He thought to himself, you know, he wasn't stupid. He knew, you know, if two brown-eyed people get married, their children are probably, some of them, going to have brown eyes. And so he's going to pull all those brown-eyed people out. But on the other hand, Jacob is convinced he's figured out a way to put his foot on the scale and make it shift his direction. He's going to make sure that things happen the way that he wants. And he wants a good-sized flock. And so he does all this kind of stuff. And at the end of the day, Jacob didn't change anything. I know I brought this up in numerous times during this story, but Jacob is convinced he's working so hard to get something. And the reality is that he was going to be given it anyway. God had purpose to bless him. And we're going to find that out down the road here next time I preach, actually. I don't mean to say this in a fatalistic manner, but we work so hard for God's blessing, and he wants to bless us. And maybe not in the way that we want to be blessed, but he is faithful. And at the same time, there are plenty of people in history who have worked super hard and have lost everything. Robert Morris was the richest man in the United States at the time of the Revolutionary War. He was a merchant. He worked hard at trade. He was involved with financing the Continental Congress. And he was politically involved as well and was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. Under George Washington's presidency, he became the superintendent of finance. I don't know that we still have a superintendent of finance in this country, but he was the first one. And in the 1790s, he went into partnership with some other men and bought up millions of acres of land in Pennsylvania and Ohio, believing that eventually they would be able to sell these lands to immigrants, not immigrants from Haiti, but from other places, who would move to Ohio, and they would buy up this land and they would make a lot of money for Robert Morris. Unfortunately, the economy went belly up. And so he had all this Western land, and he could not pay the mortgage on it. And he ended up spending 3.5 years in debtor's prison. So hindsight is 2020, but if he had been smart, he wouldn't have spent all this money on the land, and he would have been in a lot better shape. So Gregor Mendel says that if two blue-eyed people get married, their children are going to have blue eyes. If a brown-eyed and a blue-eyed person get married, it depends on if that brown-eyed person has a blue-eyed gene, if they have children. And so if two people who are carriers of cystic fibrosis get married, half their children will carry the gene, 25% will have cystic fibrosis, and 25% will have normal genetics. And that's not, that's what the science says. So I don't know what the genetics are of speckled and spotted cattle and goats are, but what I know is that God made certain that the stronger sheep and goats ended up being Jacob's. And I think it's also not a stretch to say that Laban's flocks dwindled as a result of his conniving. So if Laban had simply said to Jacob, you know what, I think a fair thing is for every fourth sheep or every fourth goat that's born to be yours. And I value your presence helping out and working for me, and I want you to have that. And if at some point down the road that doesn't feel like sufficient, you come and talk to me, and we're going to make things right for you and right for me. I think they both would have had a better result. But as it was, Laban was trying to figure out how to manipulate God into blessing him and his flocks without paying the man who is bringing that blessing. So we're gonna move on to some applications here. So I've got a few different things that I'm going to say, and we'll not spend a huge amount of time here because time is marching on. First thing is that passive men are problems. And I've heard a couple of messages recently on passive men, and I didn't agree with them. And I don't know what you think of when you think of a passive man. A lot of people think that the opposite of a passive man is an aggressive man, a macho man, somebody who lays down the law, whose family tiptoes because they're afraid of who he is. But when I say that Jacob was passive, I just mean that he wasn't present with his wife and his children as they were living their lives. He fathered the children, he supported the family, but he was not really there with rearing them. And I think the important thing that we have to remember is that there is a window where we have the opportunity to speak into our children's lives. So I'm going to ask you all a hard question. So if you are driving on a 2-mile track, so you picture in your mind it's 2 miles long, and you drive 30 miles an hour for the first mile, how fast do you have to drive on the second mile to average 60 miles an hour? Someone have an answer? Everybody's like got the wheels going. 90 miles an hour, Elliot. So does anybody else think that 90 miles an hour is right? Some of you are really focused. Anybody else have an answer? Y'all didn't know how you'd have to do word problems this morning. Some of y'all were up too late at night to do word problems this morning. Okay, so the answer is you cannot do it. You cannot drive fast enough to average 60 miles an hour. So in order to average 60 miles an hour, you have to complete the track in 2 minutes. And you have spent 2 minutes driving 30 miles an hour on the first mile, okay? In life, people often believe that they will do something important at a later date. And this misses the important fact, which is not just that we will die one day, but more that there is a season for everything in our lives. And once that season has passed, you can try to do it, but it won't work very well. So if Delvin goes out at the end of August and decides to plant his corn for his corn maize, he can do that, but he is not going to have good results. The people will be very discouraged. They will walk through corn that is maybe knee-high at best. And Ecclesiastes tells us that there is a time for everything. So in the same way, there is a time for teaching our children. And as they get older, they may hear us and yet not internalize things in the way that they would have when they were younger. So there's a lot of focus in Christian circles about how the best sort of home for children to grow up in is a two-parent home with a father and a mother. And unfortunately, I would say that a lot of two-parent homes do not have a father present, at least not fully. If dads are so focused on their work that and are exhausted at the end of their day that they cannot be present in their wife and children's lives, then they are missing the divine plan. So the opposite of passive men are men who invest themselves in their family's lives. Deuteronomy 1, 29 through 31 says, "Then I said to you, do not be terrified or afraid of them. The Lord your God who goes before you, he will fight for you according to all he did for you in Egypt before your eyes. And in the wilderness where you saw how the Lord your God carried you as a man carries his son in all the way you went until you came to this place." Ephesians 6 verse 4 says, "And you fathers do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord." So I just made a little list of qualities that I think non-passive fathers show. First is that they are present for the little stages of their children's lives. They love their children. They discipline their children. And their discipline is clear, consistent, and constructive. And I'm not trying to make fathers feel bad, but we have a challenge and we need to make the most of today. So passive men are a problem. The second is that pursuit of money does not satisfy. 1 Timothy 6, 17 through 19 says, "Command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. Let them do good, that they be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share, storing up for themselves a good foundation for the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life." So there are a few things we can say about money. First is that the pursuit of money does not give any long-term satisfaction. When they talked to J. Paul Getty about his wealth, he complained to the people who were interviewing him that $1 billion isn't what it used to be. Used to be when you had $1 billion, it was a lot of money. Now it's just a lot of money. Second is that many times we pursue something believing false things about it. So we believe that if we had the right cell phone or the right vehicle, that it would make our lives complete. And the reality is that if you got that thing, the new vehicle, the new cell phone, the first couple of weeks that you got it, you would be very pleased with it. But after a period of time, it is what it is. You don't get long-term satisfaction from stuff. That does not mean that a tool that makes you more efficient and makes your life easier isn't useful to get. But what happens is, after you get that tool, that's the new normal, and you will be more frustrated if that tool stops working than you are glad that you have it. I don't know if that makes sense. The pursuit of money is dangerous. So Paul gives us a number of reasons for this. He says that it can lead people to trust money rather than God. And as we've already mentioned, money is uncertain, and just because you have money today doesn't mean that you'll have it tomorrow. But God is faithful, and we can trust him every day. Second is that pursuit of money can crowd out more important things, like spending time with God and our families. So we talk about opportunity costs, and these are a big deal. And the third thing is it can lead to pride. So a lot of wealthy people believe that they are better than people who are not wealthy. Maybe some of this grows out of evolution, doesn't it? Where survival of the fittest. I have money because I am wonderful. That's a problem. And with wealth comes responsibility. Our job is to minister to the needs of others and use the money for furthering the kingdom. And I think we do halfway decently with this. We probably could do better. So if you look back, the kings of ancient days built great monuments to their own achievements. So the Egyptians built pyramids. Solomon built a temple, a great palace, but none of those things will truly last. It's far better to help someone in need than to accumulate a bunch of stuff. So as we're winding down here, I wanted to think a little bit about John Wesley. So John Wesley and his brother Charles were instrumental in starting the Methodist Church. And when he was in Oxford, he had just finished buying some pictures for his room when one of the chambermaids came to his door. It was a winter day, and he noticed that she only had a thin linen gown to wear for protection against the cold. He reached into his pocket to give her some money for a coat, and he found that he had little left. And it struck him that the Lord was not pleased with how he had spent his money. He asked himself, "Will thy master say, 'Well done, good and faithful servant, thou hast ordained thy walls with the money that might have screened this poor creature from the cold. Oh, justice, oh, mercy, are not these pictures the blood of this poor maid?'" And as a result of this incident, in 1731, Wesley began to limit his expenses so he would have more money to give to the poor. He recorded that one year his income was 30 pounds and his living expenses 28 pounds, so he had 2 pounds to give away. The next year, his income doubled, but he still lived on 28 pounds, and he gave 32 pounds away. In the third year, his income jumped to 90 pounds. Again, he lived on 28 pounds and gave 62 pounds away, and so on. And Wesley preached that Christians should not merely tithe, but give away all extra income once the family and creditors were taken care of. He believed that with increasing income, the Christian standard of giving should increase, not his standard of living. He began this practice at Oxford, and he continued it throughout his life. Even when his income rose into the thousands of pounds, he lived simply and quickly gave his surplus money away. One year, his income was slightly over 1,400 pounds. He gave away all save 30 pounds. He was afraid of laying up treasures on earth, so the money went out in charity as quickly as it came in. He reports that he never had as much as 100 pounds at a time. And when he died in 1791, the only money mentioned in his will were the miscellaneous coins to be found in his pockets and dresser drawers. Most of the 30,000 pounds he had earned in his lifetime he had given away. As Wesley said, "I cannot help leaving my books behind me whenever God calls me hence, but in every other respect, my own hands will be my executors." And that's a challenge, isn't it? Because it feels scary to do something like that. John Wesley had a better picture, maybe, than a lot of us do about what is important. And when I read the story of Jacob, my heart grows sad. He strove every day to gain a little, and he believed that people were standing in his way. His father loved his older brother better. His older brother wasn't a great person. His uncle had tried to gain advantage of him through deceptive dealing, and yet he did not realize that over all this arched God's blessing. The answer is clear. Laban himself said that he had come to understand that his blessing had come because God had blessed Jacob. Haggai 1 verse 6 says, "You have sown much and bring in little. You eat and do not have enough. You drink but are not filled with drink. You clothe yourselves but no one is warm. And he who earns wages to put into a bag with holes." This verse is a sad description of earthly pursuits without putting God first. I love the song, "Take the World, But Give Me Jesus." It says, "Take the world, but give me Jesus. All its joys are but a name, but his love abideth ever through eternal years the same. Take the world, but give me Jesus, sweetest comfort of my soul. With my Savior watching o'er me, I can sing though billows roll. Take the world, but give me Jesus. In his cross my trust shall be, till with clearer, brighter vision, face to face, my Lord I see. Oh, the height and depth of mercy. Oh, the length and breadth of love. Oh, the fullness of redemption, pledge of endless life above." Do we mean this song when we sing it? Pledge of endless life above. Do we see Jesus and the pursuit of the path that he took as the greatest thing that we could attain? I know that we could do better. I don't want you to feel guilty this morning, but I pray that we would understand what things have real value.